Lecture 4, How Language Changes, Building New Material.
We should return to this question of why language doesn't just wear away into a pile of dust. Part of the reason is that sounds don't only wear away, but they change. But that's not completely it. Still, it might feel like we certainly lose a lot of material. Why wouldn't it be that things wear away and some of the stuff changes, but after a while the stuff that's being changed wears away too? We have that same problem. The answer to the question is that languages are always building themselves back up by creating new words and endings while all of this erosion is happening. And it's a process that can be called grammaticalization. And as a matter of fact, it is called grammaticalization. And as a discrete topic, this has only been being discussed in linguistics extensively for about the past 25 years. So you're getting cutting-edge material here on how language changes. But basically, a language is always developing new material at the same time that it's losing it. And to understand grammaticalization, we have to understand that there are two primary classes of words. There are concrete words, and then there are grammatical words. Concrete words refer to objects, actions, concepts, or traits that any of those have. And so, it's nouns, it's verbs, it's adjectives, it's adverbs, it's the kind of red meat words. And so, man, happiness, run, overrate, red, distraught, quickly, words. Concrete words. Then there's what I think in a folk way is often called the little words, grammatical words. These are the words that relate the concrete words to each other, or they situate a statement into time or space, or they convey an attitude. So the man didn't even come to the building. What's even? Well, it conveys an attitude. It's a grammatical kind of word. So prepositions, articles, conjunctions, interjections, auxiliaries. So in, under, but, hey. So those are your grammatical words. The, would. Those are grammatical. So a fundamental process in how a language changes is that words that start as concrete ones become grammatical ones. So it's one thing to say that Adam and or Eve said that thing is called a zebra. But how would that process apply to coming up with something like but, as in no ifs, ands, or buts? There's nothing to point to call it. And it's kind of hard to talk about if you don't have a word for it. Those words tend to come from concrete words changing into grammatical ones over time. Classic example of this is the French negative marker pas, spelled P-A-S and pronounced pas. Now, in French today, you might say il ne marche pas. And ne and pas are both negative. So he doesn't walk, it's he not walk not. Il ne marche pas. Now, where did that come from? It's very interesting because it used to be that pas meant step, and it still does in expressions like pas de deux and things like that. But then there's this other meaning of pas. It used to be that French was more normal in terms of negation. You just put your negative word before the verb, and you didn't need something hanging off of the end. So just like in Spanish, yo no hablo, I don't speak. No, it's just there. There's no pa. In earlier French, it was just, he doesn't walk, il ne marche. And that was it. Pa had nothing to do with it. Pa came in for a very specific reason. There are always times in language where you want to add a little bit of paprika to a statement. And so you might want to say he doesn't walk. You might want to say he doesn't walk a step. And if you said that, then you would say il ne marche pas. And so it didn't mean he doesn't walk. It meant he doesn't walk a step. Now, pull the camera back. That was not just one thing. That was a general process in the language. And so he doesn't eat. Il ne mange. Simple as that. He doesn't eat a crumb. Il ne mange meat. And so you'd stick that. He doesn't drink. Il ne boit. Doesn't drink a drop. Il ne boit goutte. So you just did that. That was a way of kind of exaggerating or making a negative expression colorful. But then something started to happen. Generally, when you have a colorful expression in a language, over time, its punch starts to disintegrate. And so, for example, I remember, I'm 38, I remember when people started saying awesome, I think it was in the 70s, it generally referred to something truly amazing. It referred to, say, Star Wars, whose special effects at the time were fantastic. It referred to if this enormous yak came walking across the schoolyard 50 feet tall and made a big hole in the ground. Not that that happened, but that would have been awesome. Nowadays, people use awesome to refer to scrambled eggs. That's because that word has kind of diluted in meaning. That's a normal kind of thing. Peachy keen used to be something people would say with a straight face to mean something that was really special. Then it became something that was kind of nice, like you got the car for that night. Then people stopped saying that at all. There's always that kind of devolution. Lame. To say that something was lame in the 60s and 70s was pretty nasty stuff. Oh, he's lame. Now kids use lame just to mean that the chair has a spot on it. That's lame. It's because this is what happens to expressions. Now, in the same way, these French negative expressions kind of lost their mojo as time went by. So this business of he's not going to eat a crumb, he's not going to drink a drop, those kind of tended to drop away. These things have a lot to do with fashion, really. But with pa, something funny started to happen. It started weakening. So to say il ne marche pas, it used to mean he's not going to walk a step. Pretty soon, it weakened to the point that saying il ne marche pas basically, it was just saying, he's not going to walk. And the whole notion of emphasis started to kind of go away. So very gradually, it got to the point that the pa didn't really feel like it meant step anymore. It felt like, really, it was just helping the ne mean not. So il ne marche pas. Pretty soon, there was a generation who felt that il ne marche pas meant the same thing as il ne marche. Habits are habit forming. Pretty soon, il ne marche pas was the way that you said it. Now, of course, no person is going to think, my language should not have the two negatives. You just speak. And so, il ne marche pas. So, what that means is that if you look from one end to the other end, you have this word that means step of all things. It means something that you do with your feet. And suddenly, it's something that helps you to say not. It's a very normal process. That's a grammaticalization. Step is concrete. That's something that Adam could have given a name to. Pa is not. It's a grammatical word. Adam and Eve weren't going to discuss what are we going to use when we're trying to deny the truth of a proposition. That's a grammatical word. And so that's how these sorts of things form. And it goes on and on and on, this kind of grammaticalization. For example, in modern French, there's a difference between written French and the way you really speak French. If you are going to go into a French-speaking situation and you're going to be an actual human being, you can't walk around always using the ne. One of the fastest things you learn is it's not il ne boit pas, he doesn't drink. It's il boit pas. That's normal. The minute you do that is when somebody realizes that you can at least halfway speak the language. To always use the ne would make you a robot, would make you very stiff, and that's accelerated over the centuries, although it goes way back. So that means that if a Martian came down and transcribed French the way it's actually spoken, and nobody knew the Martian, let's say it's an invisible Martian, so nobody can see the Martian writing and then start sticking in the ne to sound proper. Just the Martian goes around, invisible, writing down the language. The Martian would think pa was the only negative marker. So il boit pa. The Martian would say the way to make a negative is to put pa at the end. And that means the process is complete. So that is grammatical. And it's something that doesn't only happen in Europe. It's not something that only happens with written languages. It's not something that happens to languages that are spoken by certain people. It happens all over the place. And so, for example, the Mandinka language, which is spoken in a large region of West Africa, is a language where there is an equivalent to our will, as in I will go. And it's Sina, Well, where did will come from? Well, what's very interesting is that there is a word si that means sun, and the word na that means come. Sina originally comes from sun come. The way it happened was that there was sun and there was come, and that became their word for tomorrow, because tomorrow presumably is when the sun comes. People said tomorrow I go so much that pretty soon it just became a word meaning will. And so will starts with sun and come. Sun and come could be named by the first people. Nobody could name a will. The will has to come from something that begins with the concrete. So that's where that came from. Now, grammaticalization is not only something that creates a word like pa, but it also is what creates most of our prefixes and suffixes. So once again, you have that person creating the first language problem. Let's say that you don't know anything about English or French or Spanish. You are one of the early people. You're sitting under a tree. You probably don't have anything on. And you're trying to figure out how the first language is going to be. Very hypothetical. But would you stick endings on? Like, you know, I speak. How likely is it that you would say, well, we're going to say I speak and then stick something at the end. Yo hablo. Tú hablas. You speak. You think about it, although we're used to dealing with that when we English speakers learn other languages, that isn't what you'd think of at first. It's the sort of thing where you know that that's probably the result of some series of accidents. So, as far as that goes, those endings are kind of like the male anglerfish. Way down in the deep sea, there are these fish. The female anglerfish is much bigger than the male anglerfish. And as a matter of fact, after the male anglerfish has enabled breeding between the two of them, the male anglerfish comes up and sucks onto the female anglerfish's forehead. And gradually, he becomes thinner, and his eyes wear away, and he just kind of becomes a pimple, and that's the end of the male. The male serves one function. The female is the going concern in the anglerfish world. In the same way, endings in a language start out as free-swimming words, and then those words kludge on to the end of another word and wear away, and they're kind of like the male anglerfish, and they become just a bump on the end. What in the world am I talking about? This is what I mean. So, for example, if you are dealing with Latin, well, Latin has got endings, and so, for example, amo, amas, amat. I love, you love, he loves, and Candide, amo, amas, amat, amamus. That's the one musical theater reference I will do in this series. So, you've got those. Well, that is something which has a source in what started out as free words. So, for example, there were endings like that for the future. I will love, amabo. You will love, amabis. He will love, amabit. And so you have these future endings. So, those were fine, but just like in English, there are lots of ways of expressing the future. You can say, I will love, I'm going to love. There's another way of expressing the future as Latin developed, and especially in colloquial Latin. And that was to say what in English would be, I have to love. For us, that means I must love. In Latin, to say I have to love was another way of saying that you were going to do it in the future. And so, for example, you'd say, amare, to love, and then habeo, I have to love. So amare habeo. Now habeo conjugated, and so habeo, I have, habes, you have, habet, he has. And so it would be amare habeo, I have to love. Amare habes, you have to love. Except it didn't mean have to, it meant will. And so you had amabo on the one hand, that meant I will love. Another way of saying I will love would be to say amare habeo. Now, that was the situation then. But people said amare habeo a lot. It became the more common expression. And when expressions are commonly encountered, then sounds tend to wear away faster than if it's something that's only said occasionally. So just like I'm going to is really pronounced colloquially, I'm gonna. Well, amare habeo became amare habeo. And gradually, the habeo, or the habes, or the habet, became just an ending stuck onto the end of the word. So Latin became, among other things, Italian. And the future in Italian is not anything like amabo, it's amerò. So amare habeo became amero, and then you have amerai for you and amera. Those have a source in what were free words. They were swimming like the male anglerfish, and then they just became pimples on the, shall we say, end of the word. And so amero, amerai, amera. So that's how the suffixes developed, these future suffixes. And even in Latin, if you have amabo, I will love, that had started out as a free-swimming item. In the ancestor to Latin, and we'll talk more about that later in the series, which was Proto-Indo-European, don't worry about that for now, it was am, to love, and then the bo came from a word buo, which meant I am. So I am to love in Proto-Indo-European was one way of saying I will love. The buo became bo, amabo, but then Latin came along. There was this different way of use of indicating the future. These new endings started. That's something that happens as time goes by in a language. And so all these suffixes that bedevil us when we learn a language like French or particularly Spanish or Russian are ones that originally were words. That's where they come from. So it's not that somebody makes them up. They come from this process that has a way of recycling itself. And sometimes grammaticalization can go so far that it leaves behind bits of things that we don't even really think of as suffixes at all. So, for example, think about words like nibble, dribble, dabble, jiggle. Now, I don't think we necessarily spontaneously put those words in a class, but they've all got that ul on the end. Now, if you think about it, there's nibble and then there's nip. There's dribble and there's drip. There's dabble, there's dab, there's jiggle, there's jig. In particular, think about dribble and drip. Something drips, it goes twip, twip, twip. If it's dribbling, it's kind of faster, tighter, kind of like a hummingbirdy kind of thing. If you nip something, you probably do it once. If you nibble, you're probably kind of rabbiting it. You don't nip something many times. Nibbling is not just going. You're kind of going that kind of thing. To dab is maybe dabbling is like so you have this ul. That ul means to do something many times quickly within a set amount of time. There are little suffixes like that that are much more alive and much more immediate to speakers in many languages around the world. We used to have one of those, and if you notice, that ul still has a meaning, like cackle. We can't cack now, but still cackle is a kind of a it's not a ha ha ha. Or babbling. Again, babbling is rapid fire trivial exchange. Now, it's been so long that it's not a living ending anymore. We could not say to laughle. Although you can imagine what laughle might mean. It would be the difference between ha 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 and and that's because the ul has kind of a meaning. But really, it's dead. That comes from what we can imagine was most likely some free word, now unrecoverable, which kludged to the end of words and had that meaning. So that is a product of grammaticalization. And it's something that happens throughout the world. And you can even see things like this happening with tone, so that we're not Eurocentric. It's something that tones create as well. So, for example, there is a language of Southeast Asia, which is called Lahu. Lahu is one of Chinese's relatives. And in Lahu, there is a word to eat, which is pronounced roughly tsa. And this is a word which used to have a different rendition. You would eat, or you could make someone eat. In other words, you could feed them. In order to make them eat, you put an S prefix on the front of it. And so you'd have tsa, and then you'd have s-tsa, and that would be to make them eat. Now, there was a tone on tsa, and then there was a tone on tsa still when you put the S in front. Putting the S in front tended to mess up the tone. And this happened in different ways in different languages like this. But you have tsa, and then you put the S on the front, and it'll come out something like st, and it's different. Now, the S wore off over time, because sounds tend to do that, and then that just left the changed tone. So it used to be at stage one that when you eat, you tsa, and then when you make someone eat, it's st, but the s is what you're paying attention to. But then if the s wears off, then at stage two, When you eat, you thought. And when you make someone eat, you thought. And so now just the tone change makes the difference between eating and making someone eat. Or you putting on your own clothes and you dressing someone else. Or you drinking and you giving someone something to drink. All based on it's just a melody for them. And that's a kind of a grammaticalization too. Because what started out as a little concrete piece of something is now just completely abstract. So grammaticalization works in those languages too. So that's a major aspect of how we get new stuff. Grammaticalization takes free words and wears them down into grammatical words, or often just appendages to other free words. Those appendages often gradually wear away or they lose their meaning, just like we now have to be told about that little ul. We don't think about it. But then there are always new things like this that are always coming along. So there's kind of a cycle. It happens with prefixes and suffixes and various other aspects of language. And in the meantime, another way that language doesn't wear down to a nub is because something happens that's often called rebracketing. And rebracketing is what happens when speakers start to have a different sense of where the end of one word and the beginning of another is than was originally the case. And so what I mean by that, for example, is that the word for my in English used to be mean. And so if you're familiar with German, it's like mein, mein Herr, my sir, and then mean. That's the way it was. Now, if you had a name that began with E, then just like you might say something like my Francesca, you know, please thatch the roof or something like that. You might say, if the word is mean and you're talking to Ellen, mean Ellie, why don't you go churn the butter? If you're talking to Edward, mean Edward, why don't you pick the lice off of that thane over there, or whatever people were doing. And so mean Edward, mean Ellie. But then mean became my. You know, we know that the word that is possessive in the first person singular is my. So it's my house, my lice, my beach ball. So it's my. But that means that if you listen to somebody saying, for example, mean became mine after a while, so mine Ellie, mine Ed. If you're listening to somebody say mine Ellie, you might think, well, if the word is my, well, then that means that the person being spoken to is not Ellie, it's Nellie. My Nellie, my Ned. And that's how those nicknames started. If you think about it, if Ellen is Ellen, where do you come up with Nellie as the nickname? What's the N? It's one of those things, you wouldn't do that on purpose. You know, what are we going to call Ellie when we want to be really fond of her? Nellie. That makes no sense. Or particularly Edward. You have to be told that Ned is a nickname for Edward because it really doesn't make any sense. That's because the N at the end of the old mine got caught there. So, oh, my Nellie. Well, once the word is my, then the N must belong on the front of Ellie, especially when literacy isn't as common. So this is just a kid listening. Goo, goo, ga, 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 my Nellie. Come here, Nellie. And then it gets stuck in the language. So that's a kind of a re-bracketing. Hamburgers. And we have, I think we might vaguely sense, well, there's Hamburg, which is this town in Germany that, you know, you probably don't want to go to. And then there's hamburger. And then we know that there are these things called burgers. And nowadays there's like fish burger and sawdust burger and eggplant burger and all these different things. Burger is this patty of something. And that's what we think. The word used to be hamburger steak. The idea was that this particular brown, chopped up, unhealthy meat that tastes good was something that had been come up with in Hamburg. And it was hamburger steak. And, of course, naturally, people started calling it just a hamburger. But, for one thing, we don't care about hamburg. And another thing is that there is a meat called ham. So if you're not really thinking about it, and we all have a lot to think about, so why would we consider this? You might think, well, yeah, so it's a burger made out of some meat, like ham. But if you do think about it, a burger made out of ham would be kind of a salty, disgusting sort of thing. It'd be kind of like gilding the lily to have a burger of ham. You don't want that much ham at a time. But it sounds just plausible enough that people began to think that it wasn't a hamburger, because it's not as if when you look at it, it immediately screams boring town in Germany. You think it's hamburger. Next thing you know, you've got this whole new noun. Now, we might think, well, then it's not a real one. But we're only thinking that because we have the page and because there's smarty pants like me pointing these things out. If we were in a rainforest speaking an unwritten language, nobody would remember that there was once something called hamburger steak, and burger would be a word. That sort of thing happens all the time. And so that's why there can be a fish burger, which would have made no sense to someone back in the 19th century who was still thinking about hamburger steak. They would kind of take off their top hat and scratch their nose and wonder what a fish burger was. It comes from Fishburg or something like that. So that is another way that we develop words. And you get things like alone. We think, well, he was the lone dissenter or something like that. And then you think, well, then alone must be kind of like a bubble or a going or something like that. Alone. But that's not how things happen. Why would the A be there? Actually, alone started as all one. So you're all one. You're one and you're on your own. Pronounce them together often, you get this one word. So all one, with allowances made for how those words were actually pronounced, all one became alone. Alone. Now then you start thinking, well, since there are various words like a Twitter and a Flutter that begin with this well, then it must be alone. But there's no loan. The word doesn't trace back to earlier forms of English. Loan is something we perceive because that's how the word sounds. So what this means is that languages are full of what are, in essence, mistakes of this kind. For example, habeo kludging to the end of amare like that is really laziness of tongue in a way. If somebody had been inclined to, they could have said, I don't like the way these kids are doing that. But it happened. And it's the same thing with hamburger. Nickname begins as roughly ick name. And then you'd say, oh, it's an ick name. It's an ick name. But it kind of sounded funny because that word ick, which was actually E-K-E, ecka, passed out of the language otherwise. And so what's the ick? And so then, well, it sounds like, well, then maybe it's a nickname. So an ekname became a nickname. And so now there's this N where there wasn't one before. So you think about it, what's nick about the name? It's never made sense. If you stop to think about it, you know that there, something weird must have happened. And the weird thing was a rebracketing. And so it happens all the time. If you look in the American Heritage Dictionary, and you look at where an awful lot of words come from, or any dictionary with pretty good etymologies, you see that the history of a language is, in its way, a kind of chaos. And once again, once writing starts, this becomes less likely to happen, except around the edges, such as in popular culture, and that's why hamburger seems a little bit tardy to us, as opposed to core aspects of the language. But in terms of languages as they really change off the radar screen, this is the way new things always happen. And so we have a hard time processing it in our life. Only written documents or careful deduction can show us how natural these sorts of things are. So what you have seen is part of the study of language change. And I feel responsible for saying that that is something that linguists do other than etymology per se, which is just butterfly collecting histories of words because they're interesting, or translation. So there are the Chomskyans that I talked about, but there's another thriving subfield, which is called historical linguistics or diachronic linguistics, which is interested in how we got from there to here. Sometimes people are interested in it because how we got from there to here can shed light on how we speak what's going on here. Some people want to study how we got from there to here for the simple fact that it's rather interesting and that it might shed light on our psychology, or sometimes, just sometimes, on our cultural history. But the study of grammaticalization is one of the more exciting parts of modern historical linguistics. Historical linguistics used to be much more fashionable in linguistics than it is. It was the heart of the field when modern linguistics was established in the 1800s. It's since been somewhat eclipsed by more Chomskyan-oriented paradigms, but there remains a healthy number of people involved in the endeavor. So that's grammaticalization, and that is rebracketing. And in the next lecture, we'll talk about how words' meanings change over time, and that will be about what we often call semantic change.